You're listening to Cindy's Voice, a podcast that aims to raise awareness and advocate for the enslaved in an effort to end sex trafficking and sexual exploitation. Together, we're a community that educates, equips, and empowers you to take action against modern-day slavery. Every episode, we bring you inspirational stories of survivors who have been through the ordeal of human trafficking and sexual assault. In addition, we interview key advocates in the anti-trafficking movement and have them share their comments on the detrimental effects of human trafficking in our society. Now, here is your host, Cindy.
Hi, welcome to Cindy's Voice podcast. I am your host, Cindy Rivero, and with me today is Ana Cardona, a licensed clinical social worker and trauma therapist who has been working with trauma survivors since 1996. She is from Palm Beach County, and she is joining us today to talk about pornography, the society and individuals, as well as how the development of a child's brain is affected when they suffer sexual assault. So stick around because this is going to be very interesting. In material reality, pornography is one way women and children are trafficked for sex. To make visual pornography the bulk of the industry's products, real women and real children, and some men are rented out for this use, for the use of commercial sex acts. And in the resulting materials, these people are then conveyed and sold for a buyer's sexual use. Obscenity laws and the traditional legal approach to the problem do not care about these realities at all. The morality of what is said and shown remain their focus and concern, and the injuries inflicted on real people to make the materials or because of their use are actually irrelevant to what is illegal about obscenity. Now, sex trafficking is connected to pornography, and trafficking and porn are both booming businesses, so it's not out of the question that people are taking advantages of vulnerable people for quick cash. The proof is in the stats and survivor stories. In our digital age, internet porn is vaster and varied than just about anything else found online. Pornography is also used by traffickers to train sex trafficking victims about various sexual acts and situations buyers prefer. Besides being forced to watch pornography, victims of sex trafficking often have much more violent and personal interaction through forced performance in the industry. It is possible for a young woman or girl or a boy to walk out from sex trafficking and start a new life, but sexually illicit photos of or films will follow her or him forever, regardless of whether she or he was underage when they were taken, the photos were taken or the videos were taken or not. Once a film or an image with a girl's face or a boy's face or woman's face is uploaded onto the internet, it is there forever. Traffickers know this and they use it as a method of control and blackmail, letting these girls and boys know that now that they are on internet, they can never escape this life. It is estimated that the pornography industry's annual revenue has reached about $13 billion a year. You heard that? $13 billion, not millions, billion dollars with a B. And so traffickers can sell sexual photos of women in addition to forcing them into prostitution at a great financial gain. And the younger the girls and the boys are, the more expensive the photos, videos, and making the underground child pornography industry one of the most lucrative markets for sexual traffickers. And since most transactions between traffickers and buyers take place online, traffickers also use the photos and films of girls and boys to attract more clients. Kind of like a traditional marketplace where the buyers like to see the product before committing to paying for it. Pornography is a powerful stimulant that can alter brain patterns, creating addiction. It is produced mainly for men, and it begins shaping their sexual roadmaps as early as pre-adolescence. Our sexualized culture, with its constant sexual portrayal of women, affects not only men and boys, but girls and women too. Mass marketing advertising campaigns directed at young girls seems to dictate that they must dress and act like famous TV stars and singers just to be valued. In 2007, an American Psychological Association task force found that girls increasingly viewed themselves as objects in a process called sexual self-objectification. And one result is today's epidemic of sexting. Teens sending pornographic photos of themselves to others via cell phones, via text. Pornography thrives in this sex-charged culture, leading to a pandemic of harm. A recent study of top-selling porn videos in America by Dr. Anna J. Bridges revealed that 88% of the scene contain either physical or verbal violence. Males are viewing near non-stop depictions of predatory men acting as sexual psychopaths attacking women. These images condition men to view women as objects for their pleasure and desensitize them to the real pain caused by sexual exploitation, including sex trafficking. Recent studies show that consuming pornography is an experience of bought sex, and thus it creates a hunger to continue to purchase and objectify and act out what is seen. Pornography, she says, is advertising for trafficking, not just in general, but also in the sense that traffickers and pimps use pornography images of victims as a specific advertising for their products. So what are the risks and consequences of pornography itself? This type of violence exploits women, men, and children around the world. Trafficking, victimization, and perpetration shares risks and consequences associated with child abuse and neglect, intimate partner violence, sexual violence, and gang violence. Let's remember that the perpetrators of human trafficking often target people who are vulnerable, just living in an unsafe situation or searching for a better life. Victims can come from all backgrounds and become trapped in different locations and situations. Many victims are women and girls, though men and boys are also impacted. Victims include all races, ethnicities, sexual orientations, gender identities, citizens, non-citizens, and income levels. Remember that they are trapped and controlled through assault, threats, false promises, perceived sense of protection, isolation, shaming, and even debt bondage. Victims do not have to be physically transported between locations just to be a victim, and that's a very important thing. There is some some sex slaves or sex trafficking victims that are trafficked in their houses. So there's no transportation, and that doesn't take the fact that they are being sexually exploited. Sex trafficking is preventable, so there are some efforts that are being focused on increasing community awareness of human trafficking, modern slavery, sexual exploitation, sexual assault, and addressing this exploitation after it occurs. Strategies based on the best available evidence exist to prevent related forms of violence, and they may also reduce sex trafficking. States and communities can implement and evaluate efforts that encourage healthy behaviors in relationships, for example, then foster safe homes and neighborhoods, identify and address some vulnerabilities during health care visits. That is very important. The health care community can do a lot when it comes to helping and identifying and preventing human trafficking. Also, reducing the demand of commercial sex as a community and ending business profits from trafficking-related transactions. So now we're going to welcome Anna Cardona. Hi, Anna. How are you today? Welcome back to our podcast. How you been?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you so much. Anna, please help us understand a little bit how the brain rewires after experiencing severe trauma. I know that we already talked about it and everything, but for the people who they are just tuning in today and this is the first episode, like, can you explain a little bit about the severe trauma and the rewiring of the brain, please?
Okay, so when we experience trauma, our brain responds to the trauma. See, the role of the brain is to keep us alive, to keep us safe, and to keep us present. And so when there is an assault on the body, the brain sees that there's an assault, that's a primal response, and then it just releases a lot of stress hormones, and it starts sending signals to the organs, your large muscle groups and your organs, to prepare to either fight, flight, or freeze. Now, when you experience chronic stress response, that means that it's like you turn on the light switch, but you never got to turn it off. Right. So when you turn on the light switch, the hormones start pumping through the body, and if you never shut that off, it doesn't stop. And so the brain starts making it. The brain experiences so much stress that there are biological changes. There's physical changes that happen in the brain. And then the way the trauma is stored, especially if it's chronic trauma, it gets stored in the brain different ways. And that's why there's so many different types of interventions when you're working with a trauma survivor to help them access those memories, to help them actually, you can rewire your brain after it has been affected by chronic trauma. So yes, your brain responds to trauma, and there's some physical changes that happen to the brain when you experience a trauma, but you can also, with great therapy, you could actually rewire your brain to be able to help you live a better life after you have experienced a trauma.
Wow, that's amazing. At least we know now that there is something we can do to, you know, like, fix it per se.
Yes.
It's weird to use the word fix because, you know, it's the brain. And so how does the regular development of a child is affected when they suffer sexual assault?
You see, again, it can be devastating to a child's brain, because when we're born, our brain is there, but it's not fully developed as we know, right? Because when we're born, we're talking, and we're not talking. We're not really aware of what's happening in our surroundings. But when we are aware, we're aware of, let's say, energy. We're aware of the way our environment responds to us. So little babies, they really depend on letting you know as a caregiver what they need. So when you have a little baby and they start crying a different way, you know that that cry is for the milk, or that cry is because they're in pain, or that cry is because they're sleepy. You know, because they are able to connect different cries with whatever needs they have. So if you have a child who has been experiencing, let's say, a traumatic event, even little babies, they know something's wrong. They start crying out and they don't get that need met. So the brain, that middle part of the brain, is really what's helping the kid stay alive. That limbic system that I talked about before is really what's activated when they're very, very young. And by the age of five, 93% of the brain is developed. So they say that if a child had experience a traumatic event before the age of five, it can cause significant biological changes, physical changes in the brain. I actually saw online, you can actually find this, of a brain of a three-year-old who was severely neglected. It had like an MRI scan, and they compared that to a typical three-year-old brain, and you can see the atrophy, how the brain shrunk because they didn't get the interactions, that they experienced so much trauma. I guess the stress hormones really affected the brain development. You can see the physical changes in the brain. Now, when we go, again, by the age of five, all the way to like the mid-20s is when that extra like 10 to 7% really gets developed. And when your brain is not fully developed and you're being bombarded with constant stress hormones, it makes a lot of changes in the brain, and it also affects the way children comprehend in school. So really, a lot of children, if they experience a traumatic event, let's just say the first grade or the second grade, when they're like 6, 7, or 8 years old, they're noticing that when they test these children to see where they fall in the school range, maybe they're a little older, almost always they test at the age that they experience the trauma. So if you're 13 and you take a test, and you find out that, you know, you're at a second grade reading level, and if you do a psychosocial assessment, there's a chance that at the second grade they experience a significant traumatic event, and it's like they stop learning. So it's very important that when we're working with these children, that we're able to identify even babies who have experienced severe domestic violence in the home. Even babies need to be addressed. So there are psychotherapists who work with little ones. I'm talking about infants to age 3. And then there's people who work with psychotherapists who are trauma trained, who work with children from ages 3 and up. So there are people now who are looking into different therapeutic interventions, because we understand if we catch it early, then we can resolve it, because children are very resilient. They can get through, they can identify their trauma, they can process their trauma, they learn how to live with their trauma when it happens. If you wait years, if you wait till adulthood, it's very hard to treat.
Yeah, I imagined, like, because you are already shaped on the society, you already have your thoughts and beliefs, so it's kind of hard for that. And so, is there a difference, like, how the trauma affects the brain and how porn affects brain? How is porn affecting the society itself?
Okay, so porn is free. You know, porn is everywhere. You know, you can turn on your computer and you can see like soft porn in many different places. So after a while of you watching porn or seeing things that are like sexually explicit, you become numb to it, right? And then there is also this sense of like acceptance of pornography, of like, oh yeah, that's porn. Oh yeah, they watch porn. Oh yeah, I did. You know, I was bored today, so I just, you know, went online and I logged on to Pornhub, or I did something that had to do with porn. And people will start laughing, like, oh, it's okay. People are not understanding that pornography was filmed by people who possibly did not want to be filmed, right? They act like they want to be part of the thing, but we don't know the background, what's happening when they're creating the pornography. But again, when people have these sexual needs and desires, they're really not thinking about the other person, you know, the person who's in the video. Again, they also, what ends up happening is that, you know, initially they'll be like really into something, so I give you an example. So maybe someone is really into pornography that had to do with older women, right? So they'll look at the pornography and they get really excited about the older women, but then after a while they can become numb to it, right? They just look at it and be like, okay, no, I don't want to continue watching that. It's boring. So then they step it up a notch. So then they start looking at some other different types of porn, and then that gets boring, and it just increases and increases and increases. And there are some people that it doesn't increase. So I will say that there are some people who watch porn, they watch it, and then they just go on their way, they're fine. But then there's some people who will watch porn and they become so consumed by the pornography, and then the types of pornography just gets escalated, and they start watching more taboo, and then when they watch more taboo porn, then that guilt kicks in, and then they watch more taboo. So really, it can be a cycle of issues that can actually spill into your life, where it can affect your job, it can affect your relationship, it can affect the way you are intimate with other people, because your brain becomes kind of numb to different sexual acts and stuff.
So that's where some people say that after like getting used to porn, you start like, well, the man, more likely, because there are like the higher viewers, but there's some like women who actually view porn, but they said that the males start trying to do, you know, some of the scenes that they see, and it's very unrealistic. Like there's some porn stars, females, that they said, like, in order to have this scene that you are seeing, we had it to cut like 20 times, and this person, you know, had it a Viagra, and you know, like, so they can stand the use and everything. So it goes into like some fiction, like, for me, you know, like, and I think, I feel like as a woman, when your husband or your partner comes in with this expectation, you don't want to deceive them, you know, like you love them, you want to like, you know, have fun with them, and not have them like go, like a lot of people say, go look for what you are not giving it somewhere else. So does porn really affect the marriage and the family itself when somebody actually gets so addicted to it? Can we say it's addicted?
Yes, I mean, there is addiction to porn. I mean, there is definitely addiction to porn, where people watch porn all day long. They can watch porn while they're at work. Some people, their addiction is so significant that they know that their jobs, let's say a computer server, is collecting information about where they're going online, and they risk their jobs because they can't stop watching pornography.
Wow.
And that's that kind of obsessive behavior that can happen when watching pornography, and there's so many different types of pornography out there. It's incredible. But that also, so you put your job at risk. Then you go home and you're not really connecting with your family, you're not really connecting with your children, your wife. Really, your focus is on what is the next thing that's gonna trigger your brain to get some kind of satisfaction. It's like a drug almost, right? When you get that first fix, everybody's always chasing that first fix. It's kind of like that when it comes to pornography. It's like you see something that's new, oh, that's exciting, it gives your adrenaline up, then it fades, you know, fades away, and you look at some different other type of porn. So it's quite frightening what can happen. And you know, you always hear that those people are like, well, my wife is okay with the porn, and we watch porn together, you know. Again, if you're going to watch porn together, you have to be, again, there's two things. You have to make sure that both parties are really want to be part and participate in that behavior. But also, if we can just take a step back and start thinking about who are those people performing for you? What's happening with them outside of that performance they're doing for you on the video? And if maybe if we start thinking about those people as people, and maybe the stuff they have to go through to be able to feel that, then maybe we could take a step back and say, well, maybe I shouldn't have to be watching this, right? Because then it's not as entertaining.
Right. Yeah. Right. I imagine, like, they are just consuming to, like, what I saw, I want to leave it. Because they are seeing, you know, like, those actors and actresses with, like, pleasure and happy and everything. But it's not reality. They are just working. Really, they are just working. Performing. It's like any other person, you know, Jennifer Aniston or Brad Pitt, they are just performing in another way. So, it's fiction. So, but, yeah, it's something that we as a community, we are like actually being more into this. It's more often, it's being more addressed, it's being more natural. It's like we see it more often, and as you said, like some couples actually do it and they are opening to saying it, so it's getting more normalized now. So that's all for today's episode of Cindy's Voice. Thank you for listening, and thank you to Anna and Jerome for joining us today. Thank you, Jerome, for sharing your story. And I'm positive that we opened people's minds with your visit today. Join us again next week when we talk about some common misconceptions about modern slavery, and we will be joined by Wendy. Wendy is a survivor and she will be sharing her story. Connect with us on Instagram and Facebook at Cindy's Voice Podcast, and you can also do that on Twitter. Our Twitter account is Cindy's Voice Pod, that's Cindy's Voice P-O-D, or just go to our website cindysvoice.org, and don't forget to sign up for our newsletter just to receive updates of our latest episodes. Take good care of yourself and see you in the next episode. Thank you for listening to the Cindy's Voice Podcast. Have a great week.
Thanks for joining us this week on Cindy's Voice. If you like what you're listening to, like our YouTube channel, Cindy's Voice Podcast, and give us a 5-star review. This means everything to us. Follow us on Instagram at Cindy V. Rivero to receive updates on our latest episode. See you in our next episode. Till then, have a great week.